Hello and welcome to the Access Point. Thank you for joining us this evening. The Access Point is brought to you by Living Corporate, which is a digital media network consultancy focused on workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion. Living Corporate centers and amplifies Black and Brown voices in the workplace through digital media production and business-to-business consulting. The network offers a variety of programming, including the Access Point. The Access Point is a weekly webinar focused on preparing Black and Brown aspiring and experienced professionals for the workforce by having the real nuanced talks they don't know they need. During each episode, we examine real challenges you face at work and offer expert advice on dealing with your organization, your boss, your coworkers, and your career. Here's our disclaimer. The thoughts and views expressed in tonight's discussion do not reflect the views of any organization with which the hosts or guests may be affiliated. I am Dr. Wendy M. Edmonds, and I am an author, followership coach, and professor with a research focus on toxic followership. Simply put, why do people follow bad people? I am not alone. I'm here tonight with my awesome co-host, Dr. Lonnie Morris Jr.
Thank you so much, Dr.
Lonnie.
All right. So I'm Dr. Lonnie Morris. I'm a management consultant and professor. I spend my time helping people unpack all of the crazy challenges at work and making sure that people are spending less time with bad people and figuring out how to do things differently. I'm excited for our conversation this evening. We are talking about me versus we in the workplace, particularly for Black and Brown people. And what does it mean to have a sense of community and to embody the adage of it takes a village? We know that a lot of organizations espouse that value, but sometimes it means something different for us. We are excited to have our guests this evening. Our guest is Mr. Jarrett Arrington, who is the Director of Operations at Thermo Fisher Scientific. In his role, Jarrett provides financial leadership for $6.2 billion in manufacturing operation with sites all around the globe. He has extensive leadership and finance experience, having worked as Director of Sourcing and Procurement for DaVita, a Fortune 200 healthcare company specializing in chronic kidney failure. Prior to DaVita, he held several finance leadership positions for global manufacturers. He's a graduate of Morehouse College and the Bachelor's in Business Administration. Jarrett, welcome to the Access Point.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Is there anything I missed that you want to throw in the introduction?
No, I think you got it all.
All right. So let's start this out, right? We know we have been propelling this idea of it takes a village. And we talk about that most times in our own small communities, maybe at home or with our friends and our family. But let's apply this to the workplace as we start to unpack what's really happening right now. My question to both of you as we begin is, what does it take to build community at work? And why is that important for us? And I'll tell you why I want to start here. I saw something in Indeed, maybe the last week or so, and they've got an article around how to build community at work and why it's important. And they said, though, why is because it's around creating supporting networks, growth opportunities, personal investments, improved collaboration, increased productivity, and effective communication, and maybe we get to satisfaction with that. The how, they say, is we've got to define collective values, customize training, organize full team events, I hate that one, and focus on mutual accountability. That sounds very general. What does community mean for us at work, and why is it important for us, and how do we get there? Jarrett, why don't you start us out?
Community is really important. I think of that as a group of folks where you can draw connections, where you may have the ability to create psychological safety or build trust where you may not in other groups or other spaces. When I think about me versus we in the workplace, those are really community is some of the folks where you think, I'm having an experience and I want to talk it through very candidly, or I want to be able to speak very candidly off the cuff. That's not always appropriate in every space. And so, you know, just kind of getting a lay of the land and feeling like you've got some belonging is where I think community adds real value.
I love that. Dr. Wendy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it also helps because the more time we spend with people, we get to know them well. And so when things don't go as planned and certain things happen in the workplace that could make the setting unpleasant, you can have that conversation. And so it's important to spend that time. We're at work for so many hours. We spend so much time there that there are people who say, I don't come to work to make friends. No, but we do come to build community. And the safe space is far more important. But I also think just relating to one another and being able to understand that someone may just have a bad moment and they may not be a bad person. And that only comes with when you understand each other in a community setting.
So all of those people that told you, Dr. Wendy, that they don't come to work to make friends end up being my coaching clients, right? Those are the folks who are
right
now, nobody gotta like me, I'm just here to work. And it creates such havoc at times. And we've talked about this over the months at the Access Point, when you are 100% task focused versus a combination of task and relationship, right? And so if you are only looking at doing the job and not recognizing the significance of the people that you're doing the job with, that's how we get to me versus we. So let's continue with this, because I want to stick with this idea of the village. And I love that our producer, Justin, added this in for us. I saw something, and this was at the beginning of, I want to say the pandemic, but it also, remember, the beginning of the pandemic was when we were experiencing this great racial recognition with the workplace. And so summer 2020, Huffington Post had this piece called, here's what it looks like to support Black people at work. And it's about sharing what you earn, that you hold people accountable across the pay, promotion, hiring, and retention spectrum according to race and other marginalized groups. You advocate for people of color, particularly Black people, in high profile assignments, sponsorship, creating opportunities for us to shine. Those sound like really good things to do. Is that all that's required for the village? What the village look like for us, Jared?
I really like this concept of village, right? Where we're focusing on the relationship and we're humanizing the workforce, right? We're talking about people. When I think of village, one, I think of words like empathy. I think we saw a lot of that through the pandemic. I think George Floyd opened up a lot of our ears and our minds to allow empathy to come into the workspace. And then even with village, there's support, there's connecting, but true connection, not the historical corporate buzzwords. I think of going back to what Dr. Wendy said a second ago, we're all looking for some kind of one click down or lower level connection with the people that we spend the majority of our time with. Helps us know how to communicate and interact with one another.
You know, I think about that, but I also think there's a danger, right? So people who are not Black and brown have a responsibility to make these things happen. Like, remember us in team meetings, right? Give the shout out. Let them know we're here doing great work. Those things are okay. Although it doesn't frequently happen from my experience. But I'll also say that it can cause a problem because it can make you look like a pet. Mm. And that's the danger in that. That's the danger in that. If if it's not followed up with something more, something that brings more value to the Black and brown people, then there it really doesn't hold any value in the workplace. We have to make sure that these happen, but we also need to follow up and make sure that it doesn't just stay at that one level, which is what you tend to see, that, okay, they just get a shout out, but do they get a raise? Do they get the position that's going to bring them visibility so that their work is recognized and you don't have to give a shout out? Where does that leave us?
Let me tell you why I love that, because I was just having a conversation with a colleague when I was in Plug Trinidad last week, and he was explaining to me that...
You have such a hard life.
And explaining to me that he had a very similar situation to what you just described, Dr. Wendy. He said, hey, I got a seemingly what I thought was a promotion. So I had more responsibility, more units I was responsible for, more sites, but there was no raise. So the shout out was, hey, this guy works really hard and does really well. We can apply that across the board to other places, but never compensated him differently. So he left there for that reason. There wasn't community for him anymore. He felt like he was being exploited instead of celebrated.
That's an interesting example you use, because what has been a lot of our experiences as minorities, particularly Black people, we have to prove ourselves with the additional responsibility.
Say that with, again. Say
with
it
heavy
again.
Workload.
Say it again.
First. And then you get the promotion, whereas our counterparts are given the opportunity to grow in role. So that means actual dollars and title and authority with that reach with that position comes first, and the gradual knowledge base then follows. So that is a watch out for us, and something for corporate America to have a look in the mirror moment on. Is that equitable?
Bingo.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right to me. I've experienced that, and I've worked with people who experienced that, and it brings me back to the earlier comment from Indeed about this idea of organizing the full team events, right, for building community. So I get it. Let me say that clearly. I get it. I also hate it, right? This is the people, Dr. Wendy, you mentioned, who don't come to work to make friends. Some of it feels so fake and over the top. Like community, when I think about community, in the communities in which I practice, in which I serve, it is innate. It is seamless. It is effortless, and with some exceptions. But sometimes the community overlay at work feels so contrived that it feels less authentic and makes work feel even more stressful, particularly if you are in this spectrum we're talking about, possibly being the pet who is being celebrated, that now people begin to look at you differently. So it's not that we are highlighting Dr. Wendy and her accomplishments. It's like, oh, here comes Wendy again.
And remember that the village stops at 5:00.
Come on now. It's your best. Turn the village off.
So let's tell the truth. At 5, it's over. I have been in a position where I've seen colleagues out in a restaurant, and the eyeball is, please don't come over here. Please don't come to this. And that is the expression of really not even wanting to acknowledge me. And the first time I experienced that, I was stunned, like, what? But then I realized that village mentality, that community, is for the 9-to-5. And when it's over, it's over.
I love that, because said differently, the village has terms.
Whoa!
I didn't experience... Yeah. I didn't experience a hard stop of the village at 5 p.m. but I have been in a role where we are a village so long as things are pleasant. And so if you think back to 2018, when a lot of private views were, or personal views were coming into the workspace, as you know, racism began to be pointed out, favoritism was pointed out, okay, well, now I'm no longer a part of this village because it may not serve me to speak up for particularly Black people that were getting the short end of the stick, for a better phrase. So I love what you're saying there, but my village at that point was 24 hours, so long as things are good.
Oh, wow.
You had boundaries. There were boundaries.
Yeah.
And so the boundaries, it makes me think of multiple situations where I thought I was part of a work community, as we're describing now. But to your point, Dr. Wendy and Jared, when we were away from the traditional workspace, you didn't see that same behavior carry over. I mean, I have traveled to other continents where colleagues have been there and we've never at the same professional meeting, and we've never crossed paths there for 4 or 5 days in Europe. And we're all at the same meeting and I never, ever see them. I'm never invited to be part of their brunches or their lunches or their dinners after sessions or their small conversations. And they've never come into the spaces where I'm presenting or sharing or being featured. It's like, okay, you're all right here, but you're not all right there.
That just speaks volumes. Jeez.
That's all right. That's why there are boundaries, right? So I turn them off too. So let's take this a little bit further. This was just maybe 2 weeks ago in Forbes, and there was a piece where they asked, is there unnecessary competition between people of color at work because of these reasons, because of the boundaries around community, because of how we define community and our expectations of that. And they looked at, particularly with Black women, I think some of this carries over to Black men as well, that 50% of Black women, and Jared, I know you're going to speak to this, report being the only or one of few Blacks in the room in their workspace. And because of that, there is constant scrutiny and there is increased pressure, and that the work environment feels highly toxic because of the only stance or the one of few stance. What does that create for us? And how do we get around that?
There's a business I worked for that talked about everybody's carrying an invisible backpack, and the things that they bring with them are figurative bricks. And one of the heaviest bricks in my backpack since I've been working is being the only. And so, you know, imagine, you know, my experience is this. I'm in a room. Everyone's laughing. Everyone got the reference. I have no idea what people are talking about, and what I heard wasn't funny.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, like all day long, right? Or, hey, what'd you all do over the weekend? I don't even know what some of those things are. I've never heard of that before. I don't even know it right now to call its name. And the one I love is, you know, I got feedback one time that was like, oh, you're really nice. Now, anybody that knows me would say, wow, you got feedback that you are really nice. And I'm like, no, but if I actually show that side of me, I have to self-regulate a lot in tense environments and heightened environments, right? Because if I go that 1% too far, then I'm the angry Black guy. So there is a heavy brick to always self-regulate and to try to fit in. And to your point earlier, do I go to that dinner that I was invited to? Yeah. Okay. I go. Was it a real invite? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But will I know any of the references when I get there?
Yeah. That's sad. Reminds me of, and I have multiple clients I've worked with who experienced this. There's always this language and jargon from the organization and people feel left out. So even if it's less social, right? lots of acronyms of things or people that are referenced in meetings that I've never met or they've never met or never heard of, and operations that don't really fit with the job that you do, but everybody else seems to understand the connection and they're continuing to have the conversation and never taking the time to bring you into that space, never taking the time to shepherd you to that knowledge. And it creates this distance and dissonance so that the community is broken. My question, Dr. Wendy, before you respond to this is, as we think about what Jared just described, and I love this idea of this backpack with the bricks, the invisible backpack.
I do too.
Is there something specific for us when it's me versus we in this regard?
I think we don't have to always say something to make a point. The experience itself is degrading. The experience is harmful. And we tend to deal with it, suppress it. Like Jared said, you know, he has to regulate his emotions. And I remember how, you know, I always feel going into a space as a professional, right, Jared? You go in as the colleague, but they see you as less than. So we don't always have to use our voice. So you don't have to give the appearance that you're the angry Black woman or the angry Black man.
But I am. You have I'm to, sorry, go ahead.
No,
I'm saying, but I am the angry Black man. You
but you have to let them know in a different way. So for example, I was a professional like everyone else in the room, and I was with my colleagues, and we had a presentation to give to the client, and we're all set up and we are ready to go. Everything is on point, the equipment, I mean everything. We are ready. And my colleague turns to me 3-5 minutes into the presentation and says, we don't have anyone taking notes. Wendy, take notes.
Woo!
And I was done. But I know to say something, I'm the angry Black woman. I don't even know what my face looked like. So what did I do? I sat down and I took notes. And I took notes for 3 to 5 minutes. And then I said, oh, and pointed to my watch, like, gotta go. Right. I left the meeting. I left.
You go. My absence, Dr. Wendy.
my absence, and you got up and left. Never do that again. Bounce. Never do that again. And sometimes, I mean, it's risky. But you have to teach people in the moment that that is not acceptable. I am your colleague. Why would you want me to, I'm the only, and I'm a female. And suddenly, of all the colleagues, of all of us that were there together, I needed to take notes. So it isn't always what we say, so that we do have to be mindful of that in the workplace. But sometimes it's what you do that speaks louder than words.
Well, I'm going to let Jared speak on that because I think my words were spoken.
You know, I have been in this situation before, and I actually wait for an opportunity to answer a question. When I answer a question, I say, oh, someone should get this down. We should jot this down. And I will point likely at the person that told me mm-hmm. to write it down. Mm. And I won't write.
Well, what brick is that that we're putting in the backpack? What is that? The note-taker brick?
What is that called?
You know, I've been watching a lot of reality TV in the last 20 years, so I've seen a few things. Now just bring it into the workspace and give it right back.
So this is a really important topic, and I want to bring in something that I just saw in a study in the Journal of Gender, Work, and Organization. And it is a study by 3 Black women who are unpacking particularly the workforce as it relates to what we've been talking about from 2020 coming forward. So not just COVID stuff, but also the increased lens of diversity and inclusion from the George Floyd murder and beyond. And you'll love this because the piece is called Just because it don't look heavy, don't mean it ain't. So this is definitely speaking to the backpack with the bricks, right? And it says, so in their findings about Black people's experience in work since this time, so in the last two, going into 3 years, that there's an interest convergence that when we end up working harder because of these pressures outside of the community, right? Standing outside of the community, that as Black and Brown people, there's confusion about, is there real true investment in change? That are these just current acts that don't really spill over into something that becomes monumental and foundational? Two, that there's a difference between the organizational intent and the impact. And both of you just described examples around that. So we need to document things, but who you identify to document in the moment and how it's done has a different impact than they may have intended. And then that there's a difference between liking them, meaning as Black and Brown people have to face these things and deal with them, and turning away, as you did, Dr. Wendy, leaving the meeting, or as you did, Jared, pointing to someone else to take notes. And so it's not that I don't like the people who have harmed me in this way, but I love me more, so I'm taking this action. So if we know that it doesn't look heavy, but that doesn't mean that it ain't, what are we supposed to do?
Just silent for a reason.
I almost want a poetic snap moment on that question. You know, when the question comes, it doesn't look heavy. I can't help it, but my mind goes to, even if it does it look heavy?
Maybe.
Or do our counterparts just not recognize it? I mean, how many of us have heard something from our counterparts, right, that was wildly offensive or inappropriate, but it seemed like nothing. And then that was a teachable moment. And so I feel like maybe it doesn't look heavy because it doesn't have to look heavy to other people.
Wow.
Or maybe it doesn't look heavy because we have dealt with it. And so it doesn't look heavy. It has the question mark at the end.
So funny that you say that. We dealt with it so long. y'all may not know this. I'm from the South. Dog laying on a nail, howling all night, several nights in a row. Neighbor comes out and says, "What's wrong with your dog?" Dog owner says he's laying on a nail. Neighbor says, "Well, why does he get up?" Dog owner says, "Must not hurt bad enough." And I feel like, you know, what's that point that broader corporate America needs, is waiting for to buy in that it is hurting bad enough? Like, how much louder do we have to get? How much more noise and change do we have to either make or drive for? It's just got to be more. It's got to mean more.
That's internal. That's going to come from internal. We can't do anymore. Stayed all night howling and screaming. Good Lord. So yeah. When you right. So it isn't anything else that we have to do. It really is with them. It's internal to be able to notice, to recognize, and have that desire to want to make it better. And that is where that empathy kicks in. That's where you can't teach that part of it. It has to be felt. It has to be a goal of an organization. It has to be the desire of an individual to want to be different, right? If I don't want to hear your dog moaning and I know something's wrong, I'm going to go and check. I'm not going to knock on your door and ask you what's wrong with your dog. I want to help the dog. I hear this dog, right? I mean, I'm stuck on the story right there.
Yeah.
Because this is how we feel in the workplace. And as a village and as a community, we do take care of each other. And so mm-hmm. that's the expectation in the workplace. Even if you don't come to work to be friends, there are certain things that we do to take care of each other, to make sure that we remain whole, that we remain productive, and that it's okay to have conversations in certain spaces and to take care of each other.
Go ahead, Jared.
You know, one of the things you said a second ago, it's got to be an organizational goal. I really struggle with that because I think we need it to be organizationally recognized so that people are aware and there's some accountability. The flip side of that is, it's been my experience when we talk about intent versus impact, that after a while, it just becomes a goal. Did we hit whatever KPI to show that we are being more empathetic and more right. inclusive? And then that's when it gets weird.
Yeah, it's like checking the box at that point.
Totally.
Yeah. And we see that often. I see it all the time in my work with organizations. And it makes me, the stories that both of you shared, particularly this dog one, and it resonates with me as well. It reminds me of people who are experiencing the pain and the trauma caused by their experiences of being outside of the community and not feeling like that it's communal. And they are raising their voice about it in multiple ways. So it might be through action, right? It might be speaking up in meetings. It might be deciding, well, I'm not going to do that thing anymore that I used to do. I'm not going to participate in that committee anymore. And it's recognizable. People know that there's a difference in how Dr. Wendy's contributing to the organization, but no one says anything. So it's like, you see the dog on the nail, and this can go on for months and for years. We've recognized there's a difference in how you were in year 3 and how you are now in year 4 or year 5, but no one's coming to the table to say, how can we fix it? How can we make it right? How can we heal it? It becomes something, as both of you described, that's rolled up into the organizational goals that we check off. Hey, we've addressed, we had a training on X. And so now we're a better place. We can espouse that we have this value because we gave people a 1-hour workshop that they could participate in at their leisure if they felt like it, if they wanted to, with no accountability for their action beyond that. Just listen if you think it resonates with you. But the pain is still there. The trauma is still there. The hurt is still there. The experience is still degrading. And there's no change. So I want to talk about this because when we describe community, what we're talking about with community, it makes me think of the notion of collectivism, right? That we are looking out for each other. And both of you mentioned that in multiple ways. But there is a study last year in the Journal of Training, Language, and Culture that says, well, wait a minute now, pause on that, because the U.S. by design is predominantly individualistic, that there's potential for collectivism. And because of some of the changes that are happening around us, and because we have more people of different cultures coming into our space and into our workplaces, we are beginning to take on some semblance of collectivism. But what we know about American culture and what they found in the study is that autonomy is important. People love to be able to work by themselves. Give me some freedom. Empower me to go off by myself and not have to talk to anybody else. Right? Competition is stronger than collaboration. So I know when I look across the group, particularly in spaces where we know that Black and brown people may be one or one of a few, less than 10, less than 5, that we are competing against each other for the next big thing. And they are watching us and pitting us against each other for the next big thing. And that, so if we got autonomy is important, competition is stronger than collaboration, and individualism is the predominant culture for us, what are we supposed to do? Because that seems to be what's trending, right? That's what's trending. What are we supposed to do? Are we living our last days? Dr. Wendy. Oh, Jared, go ahead.
I don't know that I've followed that far. I mean, I read about that statistic and the theme. I think more today, I would want to see, is that data inclusive of executives or people at a certain phase of their career? And then what's the regional breakdown? Because from data that I've seen more broadly and my personal experience, I live in a market where there are not that many minorities. And the approach is, if you get there, you'll pull me forward. If I get there, I'll pull you forward. So I don't really see as much competition anymore within minorities and majority spaces.
I'm going to agree in that it's not built for minorities to have the to be able to compete. It's not enough of us in those spaces for competition. So I see it more as individualistic. It turns out to be that way because of our position in organizations.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. I definitely think in this study, they were talking of the broader culture, not just for Black and brown people. So they're saying, hey, here's what we're up against, right? And so if the predominant culture is individualistic, how do we fight against it?
Oh, forgive me. I interpreted that a bit differently.
Not a problem.
I do think that competition is a part of competition. Individualism is a part of our culture, right? There can only be one number one, right? So I see that. I just think maybe more recently, it's not as intense as I've seen it in the past.
Yeah. But I'll say that we've seen this in so many other industries as well. Let's take the R&B music industry.
Are you about to sing, Wendy? Are you about to sing to us?
I promise I won't. I can only make darn. I can only make a joyful noise. That's the only reason why. You know, I'm thinking about the documentaries that you see where they only wanted one Black female artist at the top. And so all of the other talented singers, African-American women singers, were not able to have the same level of marketing, support, or anything that will push them to the top because they only wanted one. And because we are not in those decision-making places and spaces, those who were there decided who that was going to be. So whenever it was Whitney Houston, all you heard was Whitney Houston. She was at the top. They did not make room for anyone else. They only allowed one person. And that same mentality, that same mindset is in corporate America. It is the same mindset in other industries as well. But when you think about how we are absent from the table, we're not in the position to bring anyone else along or make the decisions to allow more than one person of color to even be at the top.
And so I love that you bring up this example, because I know, Jared, you were telling us a little bit about your experience right now. Do you want to talk a little about what it takes to do this and how you've been carrying that? Take a deep breath. It's okay.
All right. You know, I've worked in a position in the last year and a half, and I have not worked with another Black person. And I work with minorities in terms of women, and I say that respectfully. But when I think about how do you create room for other people, other minorities, excuse me, it's really one, getting over the shock of some of the things that you hear in the room. And I don't know if I hear those things because people forget that I'm there, or
no,
am I the
they
one
do not
that's
forget.
Different?
They do not forget. I'm telling you, no, they don't forget.
Totally. Or is it that it doesn't matter, right? Because I'm one of the many in the room. But one, I have a stop and think moment. How am I going to get over this? And then how do I drive real change? And I think of it as, which I haven't successfully completed in the last year and a half, but there's a negotiation tactic called double crossing. And so I learn all the things that matter to folks, buy into that. And then once I have the power or a louder voice, then double cross them and make space for somebody else or bring somebody else in. But I don't know, since it hasn't happened yet, that it will actually happen. That's just the plan.
I want to remind you that when you are the only, those things are said around you because they feel like this: you're golden, you're the golden child, and you're not going to mess that up, so you're not going to tell anybody, and it's not going to do you any good, and you're never going to say anything. I used to say, I want to go behind those doors and I want to have decisions to make. What are they talking about all day that I have to be on this side of the door? And then when I got on the other side of the door, it's almost as though you are invisible because they do not care. And they are very honest in what it is that they say, because the thought is you're not going to do anything about it.
It's so interesting, the dynamic that we're talking about here, because as the golden person, right, in that room who may be invisible, to have gotten there, you likely have a larger following for the people that are not in that room, from the people that are not in that room. And so I remember this experience that you're talking about, not liking what I'm hearing, and I actually decided to leave the organization. The organization was in panic. They're like, he finally got in this room, he's one of us, and he's leaving. And he's leaving after not being in that role for that long. Mm. Everybody else is going to wonder, what did he find out when he got in there that's making him leave? And that's exactly what happened.
Ooh, I like that, because that's the truth.
and I love this for multiple reasons, because I've had some clients who dealt with this, and I've dealt with it as well. Right, it's sort of that moment when I always think of it like the Jerry Maguire moment, and you're speaking out against the things that you know there's injustice, and people who have supported you in their own way find it difficult to recognize that even though they are supportive, in some ways they are also causing harm in others, and they have a very difficult time reconciling that in themselves when you bring it up and you point it out. And there's this blog that I really enjoy called The Every Girl. And she talked about it in this way, saying that she had been the one or one of the few in multiple organizations for 15, 20 years in her career. And she said, I had a constant pit in my stomach every day going to work because of the harm that I knew I was going to have to face, the things I had to think about, that I had to plan for. I wasn't sure what I might hear, something I might say. And it was heavy emotional labor all the time. And Jared, you talked about the invisible backpack with the bricks. So I'm seeing this visual, right? And the dog with the nails. So all these things that are constantly causing harm. And like the scholars said in gender work and organization, that just because it don't look heavy don't mean it ain't, that we are experiencing this, and it's okay to run, to leave, to check out of this once you confronted it or decided it's not for me.
Dr. Lonnie, I think I'm gonna pass the hat for everybody to drop some coins in for you forever.
That's what y'all say. There you go. We need praise and worship now. Okay. So here's my question to both of you. How do we stop the bleeding? Right? How do we stop the bleeding? How do we stop this heavy emotional labor? How do we stop all these things? And I just saw this, it was just this week, the CNBC Workforce Executive Council put out a piece called Half of the Black Workers Want to Quit. That's just this week, 228. 228. That was yesterday, 2 days ago. And it said that Black employees are among the most unhappy in the workforce, in their organizations, and that the issues are consistent over time that contribute to this unhappiness. That there's a lack of transparency around pay, that there is often a misalignment between the organizational values and Black employees' personal values. And we've heard you both talk about this, that there's a desire for more diversity in leadership, however we categorize diversity. So it means people who look like me, so that we aren't the tokens and the single or the one of very few, and people who think like me. And we are unhappy. We are the unhappiest group at work. So how do we stop it? What are we telling not just the employees out there who are listening, but what are we also telling the employers to how to stop this? How do we get back to the sense of greater community that helps us all thrive?
I think we're getting some help on the pay transparency in terms of a range, but not necessarily down to the individual. So you see California, Colorado, New York, there are a lot of states now that are required to post the range for what that job pays. That prevents people from continuing to be underpaid because maybe their starting salary was smaller. I do think that HR has a responsibility, as do the leaders, right, to offer that transparency and to pay what the position pays for the skill set, regardless of the person that's sitting in front of them, which tends to be the hardest part. To the listener, in terms of organizational goals versus personal goals, I mean, it gets tough when you think about geography and meeting basic needs. Sometimes you have to work where you have to work, and I understand that. But when given an opportunity, I really encourage us all to stop and think, is the position that I'm being offered or is that opportunity really aligned with a company that I believe in, that cares about me? Is that a role that I feel passionate about? Or am I just taking it because it's better than where I am today, but eventually may lead to some other unhappiness? Sorry about that. And so, you know, all money ain't good money, to come back to that.
That's right.
Okay. Sometimes I'm like, you're getting paid too much money. Do you know what else is coming along with that money? And then the diversity component, you know, I just think not letting our foot off, you know, the figurative neck, right? In terms of, if you say that you're going to drive change, I want to see it. And it shouldn't take longer than 12 months. I want to tell you, I've seen businesses stand up operations in territories that they knew nothing about, going through governments that moved the slowest. And they did it overnight because there was a dollar to be made. Yeah. But when it comes to finding talent that is within 20 miles of an office, somehow that takes 20 years. Ooh. And I don't buy that. And it's outrageous.
Mm-hmm. How about working for a company that was, excuse me, global? And the first thing they said is, but we did try to find Black. We just can't find one. Not in the whole wide world. Really?
In the whole wide world.
In the whole wide world. The whole wide company. World. You're a global company, not anywhere. So that is unacceptable. And the other part too, and because I don't want to be repetitious with what you said, Jared, everything that you said is true. But I also want to look to employers to help them to understand that you can't come with the same box of tricks for everything. If you have had these conversations with your colleagues at your level, and they say this, this, and this is what we've done, that's nice. But you can't take what they're doing and bring into your organization and be surprised when it didn't work. So if you really are committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and ensuring that, you know, the employees, that you are creating this safe space, that you are making them feel comfortable, the one thing you have to do is hear from them. It's important to let them share with you what their expectations are that you should be doing for the organization. And then you can create your own little box and make sure that everything that's in there, you apply to the organization so that it is successful and that your employees are successful as well.
Oh, Dr. Wendy, you always warm my heart when you have these little moments. I appreciate it so much. I feel like you are always giving us the Auntie Wendy advice on what to do. I feel like you're always saying, reclaiming my time every time you get into one of these moments. So for both of you, I want us to reflect on what we've talked about today. When it comes to this notion of me versus we and creating community in the workspace and protecting that community and the sense of community that we value and that we long for, we've said a whole bunch of stuff, right? So we started out saying things like employees need to recognize that building community is about creating psychological safety and understanding that and how to navigate that and protect that for yourself. I love this idea of, are you the evaluation that you got, Jared, are you nice? And what is, when you're hearing things like nice, what does that mean about how you are projecting yourself in the space, in the community? And are you self-regulating or possibly over self-regulating because of how you're being based on how you're being described there? I love this idea, Dr. Wendy, that you don't always have to say something to make a point. You can walk away, you can deflect. There are other actions you can take that show that you are taking a stance on this and that you are holding your ground. It doesn't necessarily mean that you always have to respond negatively in the moment, but a response is always required. We're never going to get past this idea of the brick and the backpack and if it's heavy, but we said when it's heavy, and heavy in this instance is everything about this, right? So the emotional labor is heavy, the things we have to do to navigate and sort of pivot around it. When it's heavy, let them know that you should not have to carry this load and this weight in silence. Speak up about that. Recognize that it is in our nature to collaborate. So even when the predominant culture is more competition-based, even if the organizational culture is more competition-based, that it works best for us when we think of it as a collaboration. And so when we are working to create spaces for each other and shepherd relationships and opportunities for those who look like us within the organization. It is okay to step out when you find out the truth. As Dr. Wendy said, when you get on the other side of the door and you hear the things, as Jared said, it's time for me to step out and let them panic. Let them respond in the way that they need to address the ills of their ways. We've talked about this all the time on the Access Point. Always question values. Are the organizational values aligned with yours? Even if what you read on the posters or in the handbooks or on the website say one thing, we know that sometimes how that is enacted is very different and rubs against our experience. And Jared, you brought us home with all money ain't good money. That's something we know dear to heart, right? That sometimes what you're being paid is also to buy your allegiance because of some of the ills that you have to encounter there. So make sure that you are questioning those things and taking it back to psychological safety, protecting yourself. For our leaders and supervisors and managers, focus on empathy, support, and connectedness. That's what community is about. That's how we get out of me and get into we. Be careful not to make employees look like the pet, right? This is about celebrating accomplishments and the collectivist approach to this, not exploiting and isolation. Stop making Black and Brown people prove themselves with more work before also giving them equitable pay and promotion and recognition for that work. When it comes to groups and teams, remember to shout out your team members. Give people opportunities to shine, bring them along, highlight their achievements and accomplishments, and also speak up when their voices and perspectives are missing. The village cannot stop at 5 p.m. The community is larger than the workday. So think about the boundaries that you may be setting there. Don't, Jerry has so many good ones, right? Don't let your foot up off their necks. And we recognize that. We understand that is an old adage, just like takes a village. That's an adage for us in the community, that we have to continue to press our feet on the pedal and drive these things forward, because we are creating a space for the people behind us and the people alongside of us. And so we all need to be drivers of this change. From an organizational perspective, that creating a village and creating a community for people to get out of me and get into we is about humanizing the workforce. A village gives us peace. It gives us a sense of belonging. Get out of the historical corporate buzzwords. And there are so many of them out right now that we get stuck on that. And Dr. Wendy knows, we've been talking about quiet quitting for so long, as it has continued to morph into all these other ideas about hiring and firing and why people are in the workplace. But it definitely is buzzword worthy now. So look at the real issues. From an organizational standpoint, does your village have terms? Is it a village just because it's comfortable? Are there boundaries that we need to break down and create a community in our spaces? What are the invisible backpacks in your organizations? And what are the bricks that people are carrying around with them that make the emotional labor hard to deal with and make the organization traumatizing for people to manage on a daily basis? Create organizational goals that create community and do no harm. It is your organizational responsibility to do no harm. Recognize when there are two experiences happening on opposite sides of the door and eliminate those types of differences. Get on board with more transparency as it comes, as relates to pay, skill set, requirements, workload, and culture. Those are things that bring people into a community. Transparency is a driver of that. And the last one is apply your business strategy. When you can go into a community that you know nothing about and set up a new operation that is profitable within 12 months, do that same thing with your people strategy. The skills are there in our organizations already. So, Jared, Dr. Wendy, when we think about all of these things collectively across the board that we've learned today about creating community, getting out of we, I'm getting out of me, moving into we, what is the tax that we pay for not heeding this advice? So what's the Black and Brown tax? If people are listening going, I don't care what they said, what's the cost? Dr. Wendy.
You know, I am going to go back to the backpack. And the cost is, if you don't heed, if you choose not to heed, if you're unable to heed, the backpack will get to the point where it will cause you to buckle at your knees.
Well, that was sad.
It's real.
It's real. Jared.
If we do nothing, I actually think we unwind the progress that's been made in a lot of the spaces. We talked about some ever-present challenges, but I don't want to overshadow that today is different than yesteryear. But that's because we have done something. So do something, because doing nothing is too expensive.
Doing nothing's too expensive.
Can you hear that? That's a snap. That's what that is. That's a snap for Jared.
I think for me, it goes back to this, the story of the dog and the nail, that when there is visible pain that people recognize, but have difficulty breaking away from that pain. And that metaphorically applies in so many ways. And we see that in so many situations and so many instances in work and beyond that, particularly when it comes to community in and outside of the community, that the damage is lasting. There are people, and Dr. Wendy, we know this from when we did When Leadership Fails, there are people who have experienced harm at the workplace 20 years ago, and those things still bother them today. So part of what we're saying is, if you don't heed the advice that we are offering today as we're reflecting on moving from me to we, that the damage can be everlasting. You might think you moved on from it because you left the organization, but you'll be talking to someone else 20 years from now saying, let me tell you what happened to me in 2022 and why it's still driving me crazy. Jared, thank you so much for joining us for the Access Point. We appreciate your expertise and your contributions to this conversation. It has been a pleasure. Dr. Wendy, it is always my pleasure to be a co-host with you on this show. I appreciate your time and your expertise. For those of you who are listening, thank you so much for joining us this evening. We are the Access Point. You can connect with us on all of your socials. If you look at Living Corporate, we're on the web at livingcorporate.tv, on Twitter at Living Corporate, on LinkedIn, living-corporate, on Instagram at Living Corporate, and you can get the Access Point anywhere where you get your podcasts. Like, comment, share, subscribe. If you want to join us live, we are at Twitter Spaces on Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Thank you so much for your time, everybody. Good night.
Thank you, Dr. Lonnie. Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.